Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and we're doing everything we can to help. We're here to help, and we're not from the government, which is why we're trying to give you the clarity on who Madison was, who Jefferson was, what they really did, and they gave us, literally, it was so minute, but it was still a breadcrumb, because when you look at what they talked about and everything else, this is how Republic Review, I'd like to say it was extrapolated from this, and it probably was because I might have absorbed this, you know, from, you know, what do they call that, when you just sleep on it and you kind of, it just gets into you. But when I went through the process of Republic Review, it actually came through in making sense in my head in different ways completely because of where I was in engineering and contracting and so forth. So what Madison's notes, his report, and what Jefferson and Madison did absolutely validated and actually helped kind of explain some things that may have eluded me. But nevertheless, this right here is irrefutable. When we understand who really has the authority and power, how can we think that the president can save us? How can we think that the Supreme Court is going to save us? They have no desire of complying to the Constitution. Are you kidding me? They walk into their positions today with a vast array of power and abilities and resources. Why would anybody give those things up willingly? Why would a person step into this huge position of power only to disassemble it completely so that they have no power left? That is antithetical to a person who has the interest of controlling power. And therefore, this is why we have yet to ever see any person come forward and actually lead America down this path of restoring or reclaiming the Republic and restoring the full rule of law and obtaining full compliance with the Constitution. So the question is, who's up for, or who's, I guess, who's adult enough, who's mature enough to start doing the right thing? Okay, so welcome back, Sean. Welcome back, Tammy. We just finished with paragraph 43. And as we look, we've got paragraph 44, so let's do that one. And I think, Sean, you did 43, so Tammy, whether you knew it or not, you're in the queue here. And so, and I just want to confirm, I heard Tammy, but Sean, you there? Are you with us? Because I see you here.
I'm with you, sir.
Oh, awesome. Great. So now that we have him of both mind, body, and spirit, Tammy, let's dive into paragraph 44. Thank you.
Thus, the right of nullification meant by Mr. Jefferson is the natural right which all admit to be a remedy against insupportable oppression. It cannot be supposed for a moment that Mr. Jefferson would not revolt at the doctrine of South Carolina that a single state could constitutionally resist a law of the Union while remaining within it, and that with the accession of a small minority of others overrule the will of the great majority of the whole and constitutionally annul the law everywhere.
Okay, so the first thing he basically says, and this is, as a matter of fact, this is the line that I see by, you know, these nullifiers, today's nullifiers will actually say, thus the right of nullification meant by Mr. Jefferson is the natural right which all admit to be a remedy against insupportable oppression. But they don't read the next sentence. It's literally off. It's truncated. It's gone. And so I've seen this with the John Birchers. I have seen this with other nullification promotions. And so this next part actually says that it cannot be supposed for a moment that Mr. Jefferson would not revolt at the doctrine of South Carolina, that a single state could constitutionally resist a law of the Union whilst remaining within it. Which basically means, going a little further, that's not stated, that they would have to leave the Union. Then now we see why Jefferson and Kentucky legislature, as they pushed the ball as far as they possibly could to get the states to actually force the federal government into compliance, because they couldn't get a bite out of the rest of the states to get any results, they chose to stay in the Union. They chose not to nullify and step out of the Union, because that's exactly what they said. And at the very end, they said, but that does not mean that we will not consistently do our due diligence and be vigilant in holding that federal government accountable that we're all supposed to be doing. And, you know, in other words, we're going to continue poking you and them in the eye every time they, you know, these infractions occur. And we're going to demand that the Constitution be, you know, constantly that all comply to the Constitution. Because bottom line, that's what it is. These things don't happen when we're in compliance. And it's not that hard. You work with the powers given, and you don't exercise powers not given. Anyway, so 45, let's go ahead and go into this, Sean.
If the right of nullification meant by him had not been thus guarded against the perversion of it, let him be his own interpreter in his letter to Mr. Giles in December of 1826, in which he makes the rightful remedy of a state in an extreme case to be a separation from the Union, not a resistance to its authority while remaining in it. The authority of Mr. Jefferson, therefore, belongs not to, but is directly opposed to, the nullifying party who have so unwarrantably availed themselves of it.
Okay. So what you just stated, and so to be clear here, do you notice the problem in this paragraph? So when did Thomas Jefferson die? Him and John Adams died on the exact same day.
I know it was July 4th, but I don't remember.
It was July 4th, and it was 50 years after the declaration that they wrote, which would have been?
36?
50 years.
Okay.
Add 50 years to 1776.
26.
There you go. So this letter to Mr. Giles in December 1826, I think the date is probably December 1825. I think the month is right. But sometimes when you write a 5 and a 6, sometimes that left side of the, you know, the circle of the 5 kind of comes around and makes it look like a 6. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So I think that, you know, it's just a typo. But it's clear that Jefferson states, and this is in a letter. I mean, see, the problem was, and this is the problem that I wrestled with until I actually, so here's an interesting thing. You know who actually handed me these notes? I didn't really know about these notes. This was like the last little golden nugget that I got back in 2018. And this was from McCary in the 10th Amendment Center. He actually said, hey, you need to read this because I think this will, because at this point in time, he was reading Republic Review. And I don't think he was getting it. But he said, you know, you need to read this because I think you're misinterpreting this. Actually, this helped clarify. It's not that I misinterpreted. It actually helped clarify even further the standing requirements. What's that? Go ahead. What?
No, I was saying he needs to read it.
Well, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's because, well, so here's the thing. I don't think that any organization that right now, you know, they go home and that's the mechanism of paying their mortgage. I mean, when you're paid to do something, The last thing you want to do is you want to make yourself obsolete so that you're out of a job and, you know, do you need more? Well, we'll fix the problem when I have enough money. It's almost like, you know, the young kids that get married. We'll have a family. We'll start having a family when all of our ducks in a row. I don't know what that means, but, you know, it's the key to procrastination. But the reality is, and this is hard experience I've received, is that if you're receiving gold eggs from the goose that lays the golden egg, and what is the goose that lays the golden egg for these people? The problem.
Right.
In other words, because the federal government is out of whack, that's the problem. Fixing the problem kills the goose that lays your golden egg. I know this. So this is why, and I've seen this. I've actually seen things click in people's eyes when they realize, hey, what you're talking about will actually fix the problem. I don't want to have anything to do with that. I like the money I'm getting off of this. And there's people that I deal with on a regular basis that I should out. But, you know, people, you're being mean. But there are people that are lauded. Oh, and I don't want to go down that path, because when I do, I already out the John Birch Society, because they're actively misleading people and misinforming people about reclaiming the Republic, what we do, Republic Review, constitutional counties, and so forth. And, I mean, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. So I'm happy to play, and I'm happy to defend everything we're doing. We're not doing this for you to become a member so that I can make money. If that was the case, then all of a sudden I'd be strangled and I would be compromised. And fortunately, nobody here on this radio show is getting a stipend. I don't make any money. There's no advertisements here, folks. And that's why there's no commerce on my website. It's not about revenue. It's about giving you the facts. So anyway, so right here, there's this story that, you know, or this admission that he makes to Mr. Giles in this letter. And so it's clear. Thomas Jefferson finally came out of the closet, and this gave me the evidence that says he actually does say that you have to separate from the Union if you're going to nullify, which makes sense. So when the Southern states said, you know what, this doesn't make it for us, they actually and legitimately left the Union with all constitutional compliance considered. I mean, they did not violate the Constitution by nullifying and stepping out of the Union. They did exactly what Jefferson and Madison said they had to do, which is great. Okay, so Tammy with 46, go ahead.
It is said that in several instances, the authority and laws of the U.S. have been successfully nullified by particular states. This may have occurred possibly in urgent cases and in confidence that it would not be at variance with the construction of the federal government, or in cases where operating within the nullifying state alone, it might be connived at as a lesser evil than the resort to force, or in cases not falling within the federal jurisdiction, or finally in cases deemed by the states subversive of their essential rights, justified therefore by the natural right law of self-preservation. Be all this as it may, examples of nullification, though passing off out any immediate disturbance of the public order, are to be deplored as weakening the compact of government and as undermining the Union. One thing seems to be certain, that the states which have exposed themselves to the charge of nullification have, with the exception of South Carolina, disclaimed it as a constitutional right, and have moreover protested against it as modified by the process of South Carolina.
Okay. Again, and at this point in time, I think everybody has a good, thorough... I could go through almost every single one of these paragraphs, and Madison provides all sorts of insights, but we get to a point where he's kind of repeated himself enough over this. I mean, I don't know how many times we've heard him say plural intended every time, and, you know, and he's been very consistent. As a matter of fact, I know people say that he's inconsistent, but show it to me. Actually show me where he's actually vacillated from, you know, the young Madison going into the Constitutional Convention from the Madison coming out of the convention, wholeheartedly accepting this new form of government and defending it vigorously every day the rest of his life. There was no going back. So just to say that he was a different person doesn't mean that that was a bad thing at all. His eyes were opened. You know, the Lord opened his eyes to see a government that he couldn't even envision. But when you look at the Virginia plan, the framework was what they worked with. I don't know. So I could test, but I'm not going to. The Virginia plan divided the government into three branches. The Virginia plan even divided Congress, the legislative branch, into two separate houses. There would be a Senate and a House of Representatives. The selection and who they represented changed dramatically, and a lot of other things changed dramatically. But that framework right there with the separations of power and the separations of government for the federal government was already divinely inspired coming in, because from that point, things changed. Because originally, I think Madison's plan was that the people, the representatives in the House would choose the members of the Senate, so that they would, you know, basically be representatives of the people. And down the road, it became the big change where they would be representatives of the state legislatures instead of the people. So those types of things, you know, were worked out, argued, and so forth. But when these changes, let's look at it this way. How many of you have ever met a person that have come up with an idea and, you know, they loved it so much that they took personal ownership in it? And all of a sudden, if you ever criticized it, it's almost like you're kicking their dog. It's almost like, you know, you're really wounding them. How dare you criticize this idea of mine? And actually, when you start really finding the flaws and you kill the idea altogether, boy, they hate you. You almost become an enemy. Some people become enemies over those types of things. And so here's the reality. Madison went in there trying to contribute to saving the Union. And when much of his ideas were rejected, moving forward as the body of the whole slowly started coming together on the same principles. I mean, it took months for them to finally start getting an understanding of the admission of states being sovereign. Those types of things took months. And Madison, when he got on board, he was on board like a rock. And actually, I mean, he was conceding all the way. You could read in his notes where he was using a little bit of his biases. But overall, and we all have biases, but overall, when that convention was done, this is what they all agreed upon, and he was moving forward to basically make sure that's what happened. So, yea, verily, it happened that way. And Madison defended it to the rest of his life. That was the man of honor and integrity that he was. So now what we're going to do is we're just going to kind of peel down. And what I want to do is actually peel past a lot of these. And let's jump into paragraph 61. And I think it's yours, Sean. So, Sean, if you would read 61, 2, and 3. Or actually, no, 61 and 2. And then we'll let Tammy read 3 and 4, 63 and 4. Go ahead.
It has been said or insinuated that the proceedings of Virginia in 98 and 99 had not the influence ascribed to them in bringing about that event triumph result. Whether the influence was or was not such as has been claimed for them is a question that does not affect the meaning and intention of the proceedings. But as a question of fact, the decision may be safely left to the recollection of those who were contemporary with the crisis and to the researches of those who were not. Taking for their guide the reception given to the proceedings by the Republican Party everywhere, and the pains taken by it in nullifying republications of them in newspapers and in other forms. What the effect might have been if Virginia had remained patient and silent, and still more if she had sided with South Carolina in favor of the Alien and Sedition Acts, can be but a matter of conjecture. what would have been thought of her if she had recommended.
Oh, no, no, so I'm sorry. I was looking to find out what part of this. So in 61, Madison again mentions this party that was created, right? It's in blue. And so he basically mentions that as they moved forward, because the insinuations of coming out from the other states in 98 and 99 basically led them to creating the proceedings of the party and using the party to respond to these other states. Really, that's what he's alluding to here, folks. And so that as we recognize, these men didn't give up. I want you to understand what I just said. They went into these states, they got two states to take a stand. But these men didn't give up because all the other states who were corrupt said, we're not going to have any part of that. Instead, Madison and Jefferson took this party that they created, this obscure party that really wasn't, you know, I'm not aware of them having, you know, membership drives and so forth. But what they did, let me stop right here. And let me ask Tammy, do you see any correlation to what we're doing with the counties and petitions to what Madison and Jefferson did after they failed? Do you see any correlation?
Yeah, totally.
Okay. Because, folks, I don't think it's obvious to most people, but when all of a sudden everything else fails, they made their appeal to the people. And because these guys were rock stars, you know, people just, you know, hey, that's Jefferson. What's he saying? I mean, I'm just G.R. Mobley. Who's that? But as we start influencing the leaders in your community, the party leaders in your community, to start doing the right thing, and this is why creating these relationships with the party, because they've been there all of this time. Now, when all of a sudden the party's actually saying the words that you want to hear that they've never, ever said before. They're saying things that are actually foreign to you. And when you hear them, they may be foreign, but they're right. They're the truth. And you're going, oh, my gosh, I didn't know such truth could come from the party. What they did is what we together have to do in using the Republican Party to take this stand and say, it's about the Constitution, dummy. Mm-hmm. So, and that goes back to the Clinton-Bush election thing. But, Sean, do you see that too? I mean, I know we're on meetings quite a bit, and I'm sure you see this, but voila, right? I mean, what these guys did is they didn't give up. And as long as we don't give up and we continue to grow this and getting this into states and down into the counties, this is how we get the information to the people and get the people invigorated to say, yea, verily, make this happen. Anyway.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Thank you. And thanks for reading that. And Tammy, go ahead and pick up where he was going to encroach because I didn't say anything. So go ahead and on 67 and or 63 and 64. Thank you so much.
What would have been thought of her if she had recommended the nullifying project in South Carolina may be estimated by the reception given to it under factitious gloss and in the midst of the peculiar excitement of which advantage has been taken by the partisans of that anomalous conceit. It has been sufficiently shown from the language of the report, as has been seen, that the right in the states to interpose declarations and protests against unconstitutional acts of Congress have been denied.
Okay, so unfortunately, I'm going to have to step. I didn't notice the time. So guess who owes Tammy an apology? Anyway, so when we come back, we'll pick up on 64. And Tammy's probably going, oh, and rightfully so. I should be fired. But we'll have to forgive each other. It's the time of season. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so Tammy, do you forgive me for not noticing the time and having to cut you off and reread paragraph 64 again? You forgive me?
No, never.
But it's I've got to leverage the season, right? I mean, it's the season to forgive.
Courage him.
Anyway, you know, there's an old saying, I feel like a heel. What does that mean? Does anybody know the history? Because we read this, the rule of thumb. I know the history behind the rule of thumb. I know the history under some of these sayings out there. But I've never heard or never found out what does it mean to say I feel like a heel. Because maybe I feel like a heel right now because I didn't notice the time. But anyway, I don't want to digress. Let me let you get your 64 on, so go ahead.
It has been sufficiently shown from the language of the report, as has been seen, that the right in the states to interpose declarations and protests against unconstitutional acts of Congress had been denied, and that the reasoning in the resolutions was called for by that denial into the triumphant tone with which it is affirmed and reiterated that the resolutions must have been directed against what no one denied, unless they were meant to assert the right of a single state to arrest and annul acts and annul acts of the federal legislature. Makes it proper to adduce that a proof of the fact that the declaratory right was denied, which if it does not silence the advocate of nullification, must render every candid ear indignant at the repetition of the untruth.
Okay, so let me get somebody to think about this. Sean or Tammy, I'm sorry. One of you, the two of you, if you could sit down and walk through, what do you first do when you realize that, hey, this thing you did right here is a violation of the Constitution? What is that process of interposition? Because, again, Madison talks about interposition with the magnitude necessary to obtain the results. In other words, nullification. Right? That makes sense, right? So, as we look at that process, because he kind of lists it right here, doesn't he? Interpose declarations and protest against unconstitutional acts of Congress. So, I think that there literally is this process that has to occur. You can go straight to the federal government and say, you've got to step down. We're at a point today, and this is why we're doing it this way specifically, is that there's no way we can actually obtain the full compliance until we have the parties sufficiently empowered and profoundly understanding the magnitude of work they have to basically accomplish to save the union. I'm hoping this makes sense. So that to do that, we literally need to give the state the support and actually the impetus, the motivation. In other words, you motivate people two ways, with the carrot or a stick, right? I mean, at least fundamentally, there's these two ways. And so we can either encourage them to do the right thing, or we can threaten them. If you don't do the right thing, we'll remove you. I believe that, you know, we need to use everything possible to getting people to get on board. But I think we're fooling ourselves if we're not working in parallel down at the county level in preparing people to start stepping in to take this job, because I'm telling you, the opportunities in going into Congress are going to be very real. Very real. Because we're going to find out that there are people that are just, they don't get it. They don't, you know, getting them on board may be impossible. Kind of like, as I said, you know, as I say when I talk about Britain, when Rome conquered Britain way back in 043 AD, they tried to get the British people to serve, to compel them to serve for the Roman Empire in their army, and whatever that league was, what have you. And so, excuse me, the problem they had was the British people were not stupid or dense, they were just stubborn. They just, you know, bickered and, you know, no, we're not going to do it. And if anybody's ever seen Monty Python captures the British hard-headed, stiff-necked stubbornness, you know, to the T. And so Rome actually realized that if they kept on trying to compel these people, they'd wipe out the entire nation. And so whoever the emperor was said, you know what, we're just going to, you know, they'll be a part of the empire and we'll just take what we want from them. We don't have the time and resources to go out to grab them and bring them back and try to train them and then have to kill them. So it's just not worth our time. So because they couldn't get them to comply at all. It kind of, you know, kind of like the epitome of Braveheart, right? Freedom! Anyway, all right, so I would like to see somebody really try to work out how that would be, but I believe that the process would have to start at the county level. In other words, the interposition is a longer row to hoe than just getting the state, because the state legislatures don't know to do this, they don't know how to do this, they don't know what to do, and so they won't be doing it until we do it to them. So we first have to do it to the county and then to the states. So this whole process of interposition to obtain nullification is a long process. I don't believe long is necessary. I mean, you know, distance-wise and so forth, it's a big process. But it can be done very quickly. I never challenge the Lord in anything he can do. He can create worlds, heavens, and so forth. He even creates us. Therefore, there's no thing he can't do, and he can have it done on time. So, anyway.
Always on time.
Always on time, yes. Anyway.
I don't know. I thought this came to mind when you were talking about that. There's over 50 congressional members that are not seeking re-election or retiring.
Right.
In this.
And if we actually had people nurtured down at the county level right now, ready to go, because they know that their days are up. They know that, you know, somebody's got pictures of them with barnyard animals or something compromising like that to basically make it so that they don't want that to come out. They're stepping aside to open up a seat. And if we actually had the movement to ensure that no person is going to be elected that is not understand that if they do not hold their oath of office, we will come after them. The sooner we get the states to do this, the sooner our problems get solved. The problem is we have too many people in office that are there so that they can walk away with excess money and be power brokers when they get older, so that you have to kiss their ring to get into office. This is how it's been done. And this is how they want to continue to do it, because they want their turn in getting their butt kicked or kissed, I mean. I'm sorry. Anyway, maybe a little more of the first than the latter. But let's get into paragraph 72. And so when we go through this short series of paragraphs, we're kind of getting down towards the bottom. But who's up? I think is it Sean or Tammy?
I'll go.
Okay.
It's Sean.
Is it Sean?
Right. All right. The plain answer is that the remedy is the same under the government of the United States as under all other governments established and organized on free principles. The first remedy is in the checks provided among the constituted authorities. That failing the next is in the influence of the ballot boxes and hustings, that again failing, the appeal lies to the power that made the Constitution and can explain, amend, or remake it. Should this resort also fail and the power usurped be sustained in its oppressive exercise on a minority by a majority, the final course to be pursued by the minority must be a subject of calculation in which the degree of repression, the means of resistance, the consequences of its failure, and the consequences of successes must be the elements.
The elements that must be considered in making the best decision. So 73 says, does not this view of the case equally belong to every one of the states? Virginia, for example, and then Tammy, 74.
Should the constituted authorities of the state unite in usurping oppressive power, should the constituent body fail to arrest the progress of the evil through the elective process according to the forms of the Constitution, and should the authority which is above that of the Constitution, the majority of the people, inflexibly support the oppression inflicted on the minority, nothing would remain for the minority but to rally to its reserved rights, for every citizen has his reserved rights as exemplified in declarations prefixed to most of the state constitutions, and to decide between acquiescence and resistance according to the calculation above stated.
Okay, so basically use that formula at the very end of what Sean read. Okay, so Sean, 75.
Muted instead of unmuting.
Oh, okay.
Those who question the analogy in this respect between the two cases, however different they may be in some other respects, must say, as some of them, with a boldness truly astonishing, do say that the Constitution of the United States, which as such and under that name, was presented to and accepted by those who ratified it, which had been so deemed and so called by those living under it for nearly half a century, and as such sworn to by every officer, state as well as federal, is yet no constitution, but a treaty, a league, or at most a confederacy among nations as independent and sovereign in relation to each other as before the charter, which calls itself a constitution, was formed.
Okay, so this is where he actually leads us into, you know, what is the Constitution itself? And he's getting, you know, I guess the best way to say it is he's stepping into this, I don't want to call it an ideology, but he's stepping into this paradigm of helping people really understand the simplicity of what this Constitution really is. But as he basically says this, doesn't he say here, Sean and Tammy, that with the respect of this Constitution, it has been lived under and followed for almost 50 years, right? By 1834, it has been almost 50 years because it's a few years shy of 50. We hear people.
That's the next part.
Yeah, so we hear people today that are sovereign citizens, state nationals, whatever, journalists, you know, oh, no, the Constitution's invalid. It was never, they're basically discounting the fact of what Madison is saying here. That this whole thing has been, you know, accepted and lived under and been functioning and operating. Now, not that they haven't veered off a little bit. The Alien Sedition Act was a significant veering. But the point is that this government really was and is and still is legitimate. Only those things that it's doing that has no authority is illegitimate. And Madison makes this point when we get, if we get into, and I don't think we're going to have time this year, if we get into his veto statement of the bonus bill, he basically goes on and says, hey, look, even if the states go along with it, it's still going to be a violation of the Constitution. It never becomes legitimate until it's an amendment. So at any point in time, a generation can come along and say, hey, you know, you guys are now abusing these things. You're using these things as weapons, and you don't even have the authority to do this. Stop it. Okay, so Tammy, let's go ahead and read this next paragraph, 76.
The same zealots must again say, as they do with the like boldness and incongruity, that the government of the U.S., which has been so deemed and so called from its birth to the present time, which is organized in the regular forms of representative governments, and like them operates directly on the individuals represented, and whose laws are declared to be the supreme law of the land, with the physical force in the government for executing them, is yet no government but a mere agency, a power of attorney, revocable at the will of any of the parties granting it.
There you go. Revocable of at the will of any of the parties. So in other words, any party can step away and say, I'm no longer giving you that power. We're just going to go and live by ourselves. We're leaving the union, and we're not going to be under that federal government anymore. It's a power of attorney. Here, Madison actually uses the term power of attorney. That right there, I believe, is one of those things that helps people put that little light bulb over their head. Ah, shoot, this is a limited power of attorney.
I think so.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, explaining it that way totally helped me understand.
Right.
Explaining it with limited power of attorney.
There you go. Okay, so do we have anything else? Yes, we do. If we go down to 79, 80, 81, and 82, let's deal with this. And we have 10 minutes to do so remaining, because this is really the last stuff that I really want to cover. And it's that big purple section, ultra-constitutional interpositions. So, Sean, let's go ahead and start off with 79. And if you feel like we need to take a break because of what you just read is that important, because I'm not going to mute myself, so hopefully the dogs don't descend upon me. But let's go ahead and bite into this, and if you feel necessity, then let's stop and talk about it. Go ahead.
It is painful to be obliged to notice such a sophism as that by which this interference is assailed, because an unconstitutional law is no law. It is alleged that it may be constitutionally disobeyed by all who think it is unconstitutional. The fallacy is so obvious that it can impose on none but the most biased or heedless observers. It makes no distinction where distinction is obvious and essential between the case of a law confessedly unconstitutional and a case turning on the doubt and a divided opinion as to the meaning of the Constitution. On a question not whether the Constitution ought or ought not to be obeyed, but on the question of what is the Constitution? And can it be seriously and deliberately maintained that every individual, every subordinate authority, or every party to a compact has the right to take for granted that its construction is the infallible one and to act upon it against the construction of all others, having an equal right to expound the instrument? Nay, against the regular exposition of the constituted authorities with the tacit sanction of the community. Such a doctrine must be seen at once to be subversive of all constitutions, all laws, and all compacts. The provision made by a constitution for its own exposition through its own authorities and forms must prevail whilst the constitution is left to itself by those who made it, or until case arise which justify a resort to ultra-constitutional interpositions.
Okay, so as Madison was kind of going into these red font text, as he was going into that and talking about these different constructions that, you know, clearly people are infallible. The Constitution is infallible. Or is it? But the point is, whether it's infallible or not, everybody is under oath to support it and defend it. And so everybody is legally bound to do and stay within those powers granted. The problem is they've adopted language and interpretations and redefinings and so forth that has never been allowed. They've granted themselves, you know, the power and ability to, you know, to create these windows. But the windows they have created, my friends, are a facade. These windows are not anchored in the Constitution, and all of these edifices, all these things that they've done to grant themselves more power and the ability to enforce the power that they've assumed is all the facade, and it only takes a little puff to blow them away because it is not legitimate. They can't stand and say, here in the Constitution, we have this power, because it's not there. And that right there, I think, is something that most people, when they're reading, you know, this, they don't get that because the way Madison is presenting this. And I think, you know, in some ways, the guy's brilliant. But we have to look at it in the context of how the Constitution is to be operated upon by everybody who actually gets into public office. It is to be acted upon in faith and under this legal obligation. So the one thing he didn't have, or it would have been more highlighted, I think it would have been far more centric to everything he was saying, is if they would have had Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, because it's all about accountability. It's all about holding everybody accountable. When you oppose it, you basically say, hey, look, you're doing something you have no authority to do, and the supreme law of the land demands that you be removed. And if the day we start living by the supreme law of the land, holding everybody accountable, everything starts falling into place. Again, this can't be, you know, subverted. Because when you look at all the components of the truth of this process and what has to happen and what needs to happen, it's irrefutable. So now, Tammy, with paragraph 80, go ahead. Go ahead and read 80, 81, and 82. Thanks.
Okay. The main pillar of nullification is the assumption that sovereignty is the unit at once indivisible and unalienable, that the states therefore individually retain it as they originally held it, and consequently that no portion of it can belong to the U.S. That it is not the Constitution itself, but is it not the Constitution itself necessarily the offspring of the sovereign authority? What but the highest?
Polity, that's a polity, P-O-L, polity. A political polity. Structure, right.
A sovereign authority could make such a constitution which makes a government which makes laws, laws which operate like the laws of all other governments by a penal and physical force on the individual subject to the laws, and finally laws declared to be the supreme law of the land, anything in the Constitution, or laws of the individual state notwithstanding.
Okay.
And where does the sovereignty which makes such a constitution reside? It resides not in a single state, but in the people of each of the several states, uniting with those of the others in the express and solemn compact which forms the constitution. To the extent of that compact or constitution, therefore, people of the several states must be sovereign as they are a united people.
Okay, so I think this right here provides... provides a light on every person that is surrendering their citizenship to not pay taxes, that is surrendering their citizenship to, you know, to get away from the oppression of government. The question is, and I understand that people get, you know, there are people that are, you know, at a breaking point. that have to do that. Nine times out of ten, once they cross that line, they just don't look back. And they don't think about, well, I still have an obligation, you know, because I want to be a citizen. I just can't be because it was crushing me. This government was crushing me. And the only way I could survive was to step out. But that doesn't mean I can't use my resources to help. It doesn't mean I can't help other people understand that we have to fight. We have to demand compliance of the Constitution. That is a true citizen. That kind of speaks to when we were talking about illegal aliens that are here, the invaders that are here, that think, you know, that they've been docked, they've been, oh, well, you're protected, or even if you become a citizen. And we send you back because your citizenship was not legitimately done. Therefore, when we look at those people that go back, if those people actually, you know, pass the naturalization test, and they can pass the naturalization test, even though they didn't do it, but maybe they studied it. Maybe they spoke English. They learned English. They integrated themselves into America. Then I believe those people deserve the status of becoming an immigrant and coming back. But those people who, you know, looked and resisted and were here to be resistance against our laws and demanding the destruction of our Constitution, our rule of law, they should never be welcome back here because they've proven themselves to be enemies. So anyway, there's other parts down here that have kind of highlighted. But this really hits, I believe, the core. And so any comments, Sean, Tammy? Start with Tammy. Anything?
Nope.
Nope. Okay. Sean, you got a minute.
I was just going to say in middle part of 79 where I read, where he said that as to the meaning of the Constitution on the question, not whether the Constitution ought or ought not to be obeyed, but on the question of what is the Constitution. I think that's a very glaring and profound point, because that's the whole point he's trying to make. The Constitution isn't an entity unto itself, but it was created as a compact between the states. So it's just common sense, not even common sense, just logical thinking that the people who created the Constitution have the ability to address problems with it. Not the government that was created by it,
right?
But the people who created it,
right? And so one of the reasons why that's even more profound is today, when we look at the you know, in this line that you highlight on a question of whether or not whether the Constitution ought or ought not to be obeyed, well, then, if you don't understand the Constitution and you're fighting it, where would you go? You'd probably go to the improper place. You probably wouldn't go to your Republican form of government. You'd probably go to the court or to the king and make your appeal for redress there. I mean, we're at a point where that's how illiterate we are in what the Constitution is and what this government is. But that's a good point. I've re-highlighted that into a red and yellow. So anyway, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And we will be back again. Let me see. This is, we got one more show to do, and then we'll probably get into the New Year stuff, and then we'll start the curriculum all over on Friday, January 2nd. I'm G.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.